Access number 32389, Mr. Heath Hunter, Reel 5. Now, what about this trip to Hollywood? Because I believe it was quite an event.
Okay, the trip to Hollywood started after we'd finished elementary flying training school. I missed it out earlier. And so we were going to travel. I didn't know at the time. It was in actual fact the journey time from Calgary to Hollywood was 1,600 miles. And we had 2 weeks leave to get there and back. And we were going to walk there. So the first stage, we caught a bus to a town called Lethbridge, where we caught a train, a Canadian train, which I think was one of the original ones that when they went across Canada. Coach had seats all around the sides, toilet at one each corner, and we were escorted on board. They were traveling as well by a load of Blackfoot Indians, squaws and all. They didn't even speak English. They didn't know which loo was which. Anyhow, this journey was an ancient steam loco, which took us down, and halfway to wherever we were going, the train was stopping all the time. At the back of the train, it was laying sleepers. A new track. And so the speed was about 1 mile an hour. And when we got to some place in the middle of nowhere, the train driver stopped it, and we said, what do you stop for? He said, well, this is where you have lunch. And where's lunch? And he pointed in the far distance, about a mile away, there was a shack. And we walked over there. We asked, when will we know? He said, I'll blow the whistle when you've got to be back. And so we strudged over there, came back, got on the train, continued our slow journey until we came to the border, where we got out of this antique, really antique engine, and we got onto the most luxurious diesel I've ever been on. And that was going to take us down to Great Falls, Montana, which when we got there, we didn't know what to do. We just generally thought Hollywood's where we're going. We were going south, so it must be right. And we didn't enter our skulls that Hollywood, of course, is a suburb of Los Angeles. We didn't know that. So there were three of us, and we decided that we'd go to the nearest American airfield and see if we could catch a lift. So we saw one of their military police and said, where was it? He told us, and we went there, asked at the garden, was there any chance? Oh, yeah, well, certainly, they said. We like to help our British chums, you see. And so why don't you stay the night and have our hospitality? Have a meal, and here's a room to go to. So we said, thank you. And no sooner had we got to the room, and the telephone rang, and this guard said, we have a flight going to Ogden. And we said, well, where the hell is Ogden? Oh, Ogden is in Utah. Is it on the way to Los Angeles? Oh, yes, you know, about 700 miles after you get there. So we said, right, we'll go on it. We went along and met our traveling companions. I think it was 17 or 18 full colonels in the American Air Force who welcomed us. You know, thought we were blood brothers, and settled us in. And it was a Lockheed Lodestar we flew down in. And so we took off in the middle of the night, and we arrived at this airfield at Ogden. It was also used as a prisoner of war camp for submarine prisoners, U-boat. And they just dumped us off and said, okay, boys, you're on your own. Just walk out the gate, you'll be all right. And so we went and found somewhere to sleep. And next morning we got up, had breakfast on the camp. We saw all these Germans walking about. Didn't think anything of it. And walked out the gate. Now, two of us were dark-haired. That was okay. But the third one was tall, 6 foot odd. He looked a typical German. And he suddenly found himself staring down the pistol of a woman PC or a woman guard. And so we had to, well, how did you get in? You couldn't have flown. Well, we came in on a plane, and there were 18 massive colonels on board. And so they checked up, and they came back and said, oh, yes, somebody's vouched for you. They did say that there were three Englishmen came down on this flight from Great Falls, Montana, and yes, you can go out now. So we were released, and so we went outside. So the thing is, where were we? We had no idea. Ogden didn't mean anything. We didn't have a map even. This is the joke. We were flying by blind flying, navigation. And we, so we went outside, and then we saw a bus that went to Salt Lake City. Now, that wasn't on our agenda to go to Salt Lake City, but we went to Salt Lake City, and I don't know where it was. I haven't the faintest. We obviously didn't have any money, so we must have got something free for the night to stay, and we stayed there about 2 days. We went and saw the where they have the choir singing. I don't know what they call them. The Salt Lake City. They've got a temple. The temple. It was the temple. It's all wood construction. No nails in it. All, everything is doweled and pinned with wood. So it's an old wood. So we saw that. And then we decided we'd better push on. We couldn't stay there forever, although we'd made one or two nice little friends. And we could have stayed on. I wasn't very happy. One of them suggested I go and meet her father. That rather worried me. So we promptly decided we'd depart, and we found a place where they had overland trips to Los Angeles. And so, yeah, that would do, and it was about $6, something very cheap. And we traveled. You've got to remember, we're going to travel about 700 miles, and we got on this rackety old bus and set up. I think about three of us and about six other people, and we went along the edge of Death Valley. And he said, that's over, that's Death Valley, about 100 yards that way. We're not going to go through it today, so he didn't go. And we eventually arrived at a place they call Las Vegas. But it wasn't the Las Vegas you and I know, with all the bright lights. It was a real cowboy town. Every other shop was either a gun shop or a bar. And they had the places where you tie your horses up. It was really going back to the Western pictures we'd seen. And so we stayed there for a couple of hours and then moved on. Of course, at that stage, Las Vegas hadn't been built. And it is now, I think this village or town, Las Vegas, is still there. But you never see it. I mean, I've been to Vegas a few times since, but I've never seen this place. But I think it's about 4 miles away. And that's where it took its name. And we traveled on, and we eventually got into Los Angeles. They dumped us near the railway station. We were so bedraggled, the first thing we had to do was to go and get our uniforms pressed. So smarten up and look nice. And then we found somewhere to stay, which was free, I think. And we went to the Hollywood canteen and met all the various stars of the day, Hedy Lamarr, people like that.
Now, what was the Hollywood? What was the Hollywood canteen? Explain what that was.
It was famous. It was actually well known. They made a film of it, didn't they? And it was just a big bar night place where they had a bar which only served lemonade and soft drinks, didn't drink hard booze. But you had you were waited upon by these various stars. I mean, who did I see? I saw quite a number of them. Crosby. I met one or two people. I actually went to a couple of people's houses. The Andy Hardy, the father of the Andy Hardy films, he was very nice for me, and so we met him. And we got to know various people. I even had a portrait done by some well-known artist. You know, she was spending 2 hours in this club, and I was picked out to be the idiot that sat there for 2 hours. And I think it's in one of my sheds. I've not seen it for the last 50 years. My wife wouldn't put it up. Well, I thought it was a good likeness. She didn't agree. So then they caught that. So we spent 3 or 4 days there, met various people. I met a fellow called Harry Revell who wrote, Have You Ever Seen a Dream Walking? That was one of his famous hits. And he was quite a nice bloke. I think he was odd, mind you. Very odd. Then it came to coming home. We'd never thought of coming. We hadn't thought that we'd travel 1,600 miles. So I think we left ourselves 2.5 days to get back. And that's a long way to go when you've got no means of transport except your feet. And so we went outside onto the road. We found the road which we headed up towards Canada. I don't know what it was. I went up via Sacramento, skirted the... God, I've lost the name now. You're about 80 miles from San Francisco. We never went to San Francisco. And so we were inland all the time. On the way back, we met one family dashed out of their house to see us. They didn't often see English uniforms. But they were English. They'd come from Newcastle. So they invited us and gave us a meal. And I think they gave us $5 each to continue our journey. Of course, we had no money. I think by this time I'd cashed in My mother had given me a fiver for emergencies, and I'd been to a bank and got $5, real dollars, for £5. Because that was the rate of exchange. And we continued. One time we had a ride on a wagon, a horse-drawn wagon, carrying hay. So he was travelling about a mile an hour faster than we were walking. Then we got to another place we were stopped off. Absolutely nothing there, absolutely barren, semi-desert it was. And a car came up. They were taking a kid to hospital, about 80 miles, so they gave us a lift for 80 miles. And then they dropped us off, and on we plodded, wondering where the hell we were going to ever get anywhere. And eventually we were picked up by two American Air Force men, officers they were. And by this time, one of the chaps had left us. He'd decided he wasn't going to have this, and he'd gone back to Hollywood. And then he went to the British Embassy, claimed that he couldn't get back, and so they put him on the plane, and that was it. We didn't meet him till we got back home. We continued with this, and we went up. We went to a funny place called Walla Walla, on the Snake River, I think it was. And we stayed there the night. We slept overnight in the fire station with all the bugs that were going there. Fortunately, we didn't catch anything. And then we proceeded. We continued on. We got to the Canadian border eventually. I don't know how. We got the Canadian border and decided we better catch the train as we were getting within a few minutes, actually. Not hours. Minutes of being overdue. And the train came, took us to Lethbridge again, and then we got from Lethbridge up to the camp, and we arrived in about a quarter of an hour late. Subsequently, so we were absent without leave, you see, straight away, both of us. But when we got the same morning, we were posted. We didn't miss the posting. We were on the posting.
Now, hang on. When was this, by the way? Because you were at Claire's home from September 44 to when, do you think?
44. In 44, end of 44.
December.
Yeah, December. But this was before that. This is before we went on a my gardening spree.
I understand, yeah.
Mm. We were then posted, which was the posting. We were all ready for the posting. I was posted to one station. I was went to... at that stage, I went to... the gardening centre, and he was posted elsewhere.
So that was when you went to your gardening leave? Or
that's my gardening sojourn, yeah.
Now, so what next this time? So you passed out, so what happens then?
Passed out, we went and we stayed in for 5 weeks in a place called Moncton, M-O-N-C-K-T-O-N, or M-O-N-C-T-O-N, which is the place where we'd started from a year before.
And does that take you over Christmas?
That took us to Christmas. And then we went from there, we went down by rail again to New York, and we went on board the QE1, the big one.
The Queen Elizabeth.
Queen Elizabeth, the first one. Which, you know, looked magnificent, but of course the ship was never fitted out. It was still just the hull and the engines. Inside it was just nothing. And they had, we were lucky, we had a cabin which would normally have been for two people. I think we had 14 in there. And it was, the bunks were made in such a fashion that they could put extra beds in to carry wounded. And so, you know, you need cat's whiskers to measure whether you're getting to bed or not. It was so close together. And so I think we had 14 people in this room and one toilet. But we were in luxury compared with the Americans. So they were downstairs in the hold where they'd got tiers and tiers of bunks.
Were you on this boat at Christmas? Or
no, we came. We were
still in December then?
Yeah, it'd be December.
So you were at Moncton November to December?
Yeah, yeah.
So you finished a course in November.
Yep.
Right. So what? Anything else you remember about the trip back on the?
No, I can remember it being pretty stormy, but what amazed me was talking to some of these American fellows. They all went around with their Colt in a hole. So all the crew members, everybody on the ship except the English, were armed. And of course, Americans, when they're armed, they've got bullets in them. But if you had anything in England, you never saw a bullet until you were told to fire. But the Americans were a bit casual in that way. And these, a lot of these darkies and, well, some of the poor whites, they didn't know that the Atlantic existed. They'd never seen so much water. And to be on a big ship was quite beyond them, especially these chaps who'd been down in Alabama working the fields. They'd never seen water like it. And we went into, I think we landed at Greenock, Scotland, where we got a train. We were immediately issued with American rations for the journey down. I'm not very fond of these packed rations. Even American ones were, to my mind, not nice. But they were made so you could eat them either cold or you could cook them. Well, we had no heating system on the train, so it was a case of getting a spoon out and eating this stuff. That's when we were introduced to Spam for the first time. I'd never had Spam before. So we got Spam. I was looking forward to corned beef, but Spam was out of this world. People didn't like it. I thought it was quite good. We then travelled down, and where did they dump us? They dropped us off, I think, in Leeds. And then we were collected and taken to a place called Panal, which is Panal, P-A-N-A-L, which is near Harrogate. And this was a holding centre on your return.
Now, what were you doing at the holding camp then?
Nothing at all. We just scrounged and went
there. So you were there at Christmas then?
Just after Christmas, maybe, yeah. Maybe so I got some more leave, I don't remember.
And you were there till January?
Yeah.
And anything happening at all there?
Nothing at all. Nothing at all. You're free agents, free spirits. You followed the rules. You got up in the morning and that was it. Had your meals and went out. It was a scrounge.
Did you realise the war was coming to an end?
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't. It was on it the last straight. Did you realise that?
Oh, we knew that. But we never saw any English news, and we only heard the odd broadcast. I don't think anybody all the camps I've ever had a radio, so you were out of touch. You had to see a local paper to get any sort of idea what was going on. We knew the war was well advanced at this stage.
Now, there's two ways of looking at the end of the war if you're in the sort of job you were in. One is to be pleased that you're not going to have to fight.
No, we were all bloody annoyed. It was their fault that we hadn't finished the training in time. The other thing, of course, is by not getting involved, I'm probably here now. If I'd been pushed in 43, as I could have been, I might have been dead. I mean, one of the chaps on our... When I was at ITW, a chap was with us. He failed the five-week exam, and he opted to go as an air gunner. And before we'd finished the course of 12 weeks, we'd had a message back he was dead. He'd gone as a gunner and was killed. So it was at the height of when the people were getting killed in a big way.
So did you want to fly missions then at the time?
At the time, we were all... I think at the time, we were all very eager to do it. It wasn't a case of you wanting to come back and getting something. I mean, one of my pals came back earlier than me, and he finished up. He was flying navigators from the Isle of Man. But, we didn't get the chance to do that. We came back, and I was asked if would I go on a course, an engineering course, to fill in time.
Now, when was this?
That was just after Christmas.
So what was this end? Where was that at?
That was at St. Athol, which was down in Wales, South Wales, near Barry.
And what do you remember of the engineering course?
They gave me an engineering course on Lancasters and mosquitoes. But mainly all what you were learning about was the engines, the propellers and the systems in each aircraft.
Not much use to you as a pilot, really.
It was more advanced, more information for me, but it was not beneficial, really. We were there for about 8 weeks, I think, 8 weeks. But we did the engineering course, which flight engineers did in 26 weeks. We're supposed to do the same course in 8 weeks, and then we finished that. And
so that would be what, March?
Yeah, or was it March? March? Yes, around about March.
War was still going on then.
War was still on.
So what next?
Then I was posted to a heavy conversion unit. No, it wasn't. I was posted to an OTU, first of all.
Operational training. Do you know which one?
No. I forgot. In the Midlands somewhere. No, I forgot the name.
You don't know where it was?
Yeah, I know where it was. I know that that's where the fire service have their headquarters now, I think. The existing fire service.
I don't know where that is, I'm afraid.
Not very far from Stratford. No, it wasn't Stratford we used to go to. And I was there for a few weeks. And I flew Wellington's there. And then I
went... Hang on, can we track down where it is first? So where's this fire service?
Let me get the Atlas out in the marsh.
Morton in the marsh.
Oxford.
We're on. That was around about March 45.
Yeah.
Now, you were there to fly the Wellington and form a crew at OTU.
That's it, yeah, crew.
What was the nature of what was the Wellington like to fly for you?
I thought it was a simple aircraft. It was a simple conversion from flying Anson's, which I'd done before. It was just a bit bigger brute, that was all. No, there was nothing wrong. It always smelt of petrol. You just couldn't get away from that. But there was nothing difficult about the plane. And that was twin engine. And then from when we'd finished
Now, how do you go about forming your crew then?
You just walked around and talked to people and decided who you liked. You were allowed to have who you wanted. And obviously by this stage that you were not going to get a full crew. You were only going to get five. Because you'd have to pick up two of the people later.
Which two?
You'd pick up a flight engineer and a mid-upper gunner. But all the rest...
Now, how did you pick your crew? Well, I mean, were you looking for nice people or competent people?
Well, you didn't know how competent they were. They never told you. You took pot luck. I mean, I had a bomb in me. I could have bombed blind without... He wouldn't know. He didn't even see the target. And two gunners that could, in the turrets, when you try them on the ground, they couldn't even see the aeroplanes. And I used to get in the thing, and I saw it immediately. We clicked. We were able to do it. But they were all right in the end. And they were nice people.
Now, what sort of training were you doing at Morton?
Well, all you did was circuits and bumps and a couple of cross countries. The cross country up to the north of Scotland. Or a three-legged thing, same as you'd done in smaller aircraft in Canada.
And how did the crew meld together during those cross-country flights?
Oh, they got used to my flying, and I got used to their idiosyncrasies.
Were you all sergeants?
I was a flight sergeant, I think. I think I was a flight at that time, and the others were all sergeants.
Now, did you socialise with them? Straight away,
we did go. We went out boozing together. Yes, that's about all we did. I think we had one bloke didn't drink, so he never went. But everybody else, the bomb aimer and the navigator, they'd been at nav school together, so they were close before we met them. They both knew each other. And then there was the rear gunner. Well, he just came in. We didn't know where he came from. He actually came from Woodley, near Reading.
So were you there at Morton when the war ended? Oh, sorry, the war in Europe, VE Day.
No. I was still at Cardiff, I think. I was down in Wales at that time. So it must have been May when I was there.
Right, okay, that's all right. So it's May you go to. Mm. So you're at Harrogate and at St Athens until May.
Mm.
Okay. How did you feel, dropping back in it, when you heard the war was over in Europe? Were there any VE Day celebrations?
Well, no, we were incorporated in a VE march through Cardiff. They bussed everybody in so we could march up and down the streets to the applause of the public. And there we were, not one of us had flown on operations. But we had the wings and all the rest, and we could look smart. But
right. Then you went to Morton in the Marsh. Did it all seem a bit of a waste of time, or did you think you were going off to fight the Japanese?
At that stage, I thought I was going to stay in the Air Force.
But did you think you were going to fight the Japanese?
Yes.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I wasn't looking forward to it. Not really.
Why not? Other than if you can explain it.
To fly a Lancaster out there, I think, unless you flew at night again, I would have been suicidal. But, of course, at that stage, we didn't know how well the Americans were doing, because the Americans shot hundreds of Japanese planes down and destroyed them on the ground. You didn't know any of this. It was only when you see the World at War on television today that you see the destruction there and the havoc they caused. But we didn't know this. We assumed that we would go, once we'd finished at Heavy Con, we'd be posted overseas.
At where? At Morton the Marsh?
No, that was when I'd been posted from there. I was thinking about it then, but we were on the Lancaster.
When were you posted to this Heavy Conversion Unit?
Heavy Conversion Unit was North Luffenham.
And when did you go there?
July time? It must have been.
Just before the war ended.
Just as the war was ending, yeah.
And what were you doing there? What was it like flying the Lancaster?
Well, it's a difficult. It was a very easy aircraft to fly. Very easy. It had no bad habits, put it that way. And, you were going to convert here from a twin-engine aircraft to a four-engine. So all you were doing was getting used to four engines.
What does that entail? What does it mean in practical terms? Well, you've got as a pilot,
you've got four throttles to handle, but the flying characteristics are the same as anything else, even a single engine aircraft. They tell you it's going to swing to the right, so you compensate for that before you take off. Then you take off, and you just got to remember you've got four engines, and the plane flew beautifully.
Now, what sort of? Did you do any practice bombing or anything there? Or
we had a couple of runs on the bombing range.
That was at North Luffenham, was it?
At North Luffenham, yeah.
And how did that go?
Very badly. I think my bomber hit the bloody road instead of the target. He didn't get it right. The first time, I thought he was a right hash. Second time, I think we improved. But he was not a good bomber.
And did you do any air where fighters pretend to attack you, that kind of air affiliation, I think they call it, exercises?
What's that?
Where fighters pretend to attack you.
Oh, yeah, we had a couple of runs with Spitfires. They messed about with us. And
what sort of... Had you learned how to do the corkscrew and things like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, tell us what the corkscrew, because you haven't mentioned any of that. When did you learn that?
Well, first time I ever... On Twins, we did corkscrewing.
Yeah, tell me what the corkscrew was. How did it work?
Well, it's you dived... The fellow at the back, the rear gunner, tells you where the plane is, where he's coming from, and you dive. You dive first of all, and when you get to the bottom of the dive, you then swing the aircraft around and climb the other side, just as a corkscrew. You go down, then you go up, and you go over the top, and you go down again. So you're not flying a straight course. It's supposed to be they can't really line you up to shoot you down. I wouldn't like to try it out in reality, though.